Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this special FX podcast from SIGGRAPH 2013 in Anaheim, California. Joining me is Mike Seymour. This is Jeff Huser.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
Good.
So as we discussed on the special FX podcast yesterday when we were looking at Fabric Engine, we're going to be bringing you new news as it breaks. And today we're able to announce for the first time that not only is RenderMan supported in Katana, but in fact, Katana will ship with RenderMan. Now, we've got an interview coming up in a few minutes with that, with both people from Pixar and from the Foundry. But Jeff, before we get to that interview, a bit of a chat about SIGGRAPH itself, back at Anaheim, one of your sort of regular stomping grounds.
Disney-holic that I be. Yeah, it's pretty funny. We'd been away from Anaheim for long enough that I had kind of forgotten how nice it is. The convention center is very lovely, and hotels are easy, and lots of options for food around, and it's good.
We went to the effects omelet this morning. I joked that this should be, in fact, called the Houdini session, because almost every session from every company from... it was DreamWorks that did the Frost one, right? That was a DreamWorks production.
Yeah.
Through to stuff from Pixar on Bubbles, through to DNEG, which gave two interesting papers on both fluids and on massive building destruction in Man of Steel. All of it had it there somewhere, a Houdini effects element.
Yeah, that was pretty predominant in that talk. There's some great stuff. Some of the procedural stuff with the way they were building buildings at DNEG, making windows appear where you'd naturally want them to appear and things. So it was interesting stuff.
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about that. The Partiosaurus Rex was the program that, or rather the short film that had the bubbles coming out of the Canadian Pixar. And that was a Houdini particle model and kind of randomization thing that led and built out the bubbles. I've got to say that was interesting, as was, as I say, the stuff to do with the new fluid sim stuff coming out of, which is actually probably more technical, actually, the Dynamo engine replacing Squirt at DNEG. It's a bit hard to explain that on a podcast because it was a pretty technical session.
But the bubbles thing was really interesting because it's an interesting problem, and the scale that it grows to pretty quickly is easy to understate when you think about bubbles.
Yep.
You end up
using
with
a
spring
mechanism, right?
Yeah, it was really cool. Instead of they started off animating the bubbles as they intersect and how they pull into each other, and went to a spring type system, which was really clever.
Yeah, the Man of Steel session was a cracker. Basically, they were taking City Engine, which we've seen before. In fact, it was used by DNEG on Total Recall. You basically have, you produce manifold kit parts together into a kind of large set of cities. The thing about these is you want to be able to shatter them, and to shatter them and therefore shatter and sim them for the knockdowns that are going to happen in part of Superman, you have to sort of build them in a certain way. It was, in fact, in that pipeline, a bit of a interesting thing because of the way the buildings were created. While the system that was set up out of City Engine would produce very good-looking stuff for in fact, rendering, there was a bit of a bottleneck they outlined where they had to go in and manually tweak things so as to allow the vertexes to be correct for the shattering. But that being said, I thought it was really interesting, Jeff, how they were instancing the shattering. So if you had a window and a thing worked out and you worked out how to shatter it, you could then, wherever that window and stuff was used, it would instance it out, and you could obviously vary that so it wouldn't have to use it the same one each time. But it would just basically mean you saw this propagation of the shatter solutions through the models as they went into the HDA, or rather the Houdini digital asset went into the pipeline at DNEG.
The other thing I thought was interesting in that talk was the concept, who's showing how many steps they have to go through right now to go through and do that, to process all that data, and the constant thought process they go through in the R&D departments and things like that to figure out, okay, well, next time what we'd really like to do is get it down to these two steps, because that would make everybody's life a lot easier and make things a lot cleaner and simpler.
So if I remember it correctly, the City Engine exported their YMCA file, but it's YMC file, right? They always get that wrong.
YAML, I think they called it.
Yeah, it's YAMC. I'm always going to say that. And then anyway, that gets converted into an asset that they can use for the buildings. That's something that can be taken in to the system that DNEG uses. As I say, the you have the gosh, I'm a bit tongue-tied because I'm a bit jet-lagged. And the HDA files, which then, of course, they do the fracturing on and stuff, get ready for the pipeline that's going to be handed through. But the thing about all that, those multiple steps, is that, as they said, they're building it out, so they're basically going to build a building next time, and that would be an asset you could use in a city or an asset that was already built friendly for fracturing and breaking out. And that held out the promise of removing this kind of analog step in the middle that involved somebody having to sort of frig around with stuff. But their rigid body sims were doing about 80,000 objects, 160,000 when you allow for the extra sort of secondary stuff that they were adding into it. But I just thought it was a really good talk. It was well done. DNEG had put a lot of work into putting it together and showing examples, including discussing things that didn't work, like that shot where they showed Superman flying through a glass building. Not very super, just broke a couple of windows.
Right, so they changed it up.
To give you an idea how impressive that is, when they had one of the shots of the ship coming in after it's been, if you've seen the film, derailed, I guess, at the end, and it's coming in to crash down onto poor Metropolis, there's a shot where they have this massive amount of damage as the ship kind of basically clipping all of these buildings. And so from getting that shot kind of as a, you know, okay, we're going to start about it and get something to have a look at, so the from that sort of point of, okay, here's the ship going through the buildings. Of course, the assets are all built and they've gone and invested all this time in setting all this up. And it took months to get it to this point. But when they start that individual shot, it was only 48 hours before they could get the first thing into dailies to have a look at it and see what the it looked like with rigid body sims in there and a, you know, a bunch of destruction stuff rendered up. On other shots, like where he was flying through the building, when I said it wasn't super enough, and that they ended up having him flying through a different building, transferring him from going through one building, didn't look sort of dramatic enough, to a different style of building that had more concrete spraying out. That was just one day to turn that shot around to get it into dailies to start the process. Now, that's not from beginning to final, and of course they had to put a lot of work in to build all those assets to be ready to go. But it gives you an idea if you can sort of, if someone says, okay, I'm going to start on a shot now, and a day later you can start putting something in front of a supervisor to look at and start commenting on. Jeff, yeah. Your experience, that's got to be great.
Well, in fact, I think they even said that, you know, one of the things they've found is because they put so much work in on the front end of the project, they actually ended up using one of those first renders for a screening. Because
really?
It was far enough along that they could drop it in for a temp into the screening, which I thought was pretty impressive. And it just shows the power of doing all that preparation work and a lot of that automated work that you know, is going to speed up building things that are procedural that you're going to know you're going to need, like cities. You're going to need buildings with lots of windows. Let's make that easier.
Well, as we said at the start, we had a big announcement from the Foundry and Pixar. We got an exclusive pre-interview, as we're providing to you this week, with both the Foundry and Pixar. But rather than me explain it all now, let's cross to that interview we recorded just a few hours ago. And we'll come back afterwards and tell you a bit more about what's happening here at SIDGRAPH 2013.
Mike, before we go to that, let me just jump in here. We're going to hear your voice, obviously. And then following that will be Simon Robinson, chief scientist and one of the co-founders of the Foundry, Chris Ford, business director for RenderMan at Pixar, and then Chris Kennessy, chief sales and marketing officer for the Foundry.
So thanks, everyone, for joining us. We have a really interesting announcement here at SIDGRAPH 2013. And Simon, we have some really interesting news coming out from the Foundry and, in fact, from Pixar with RenderMan. But starting with you first with the Foundry, what's the news?
Yeah, so the exciting thing for us is that from now on, we're able to release Katana with RenderMan inside it. So this is a really big step for us because while people appreciate that Katana has and will continue to be very render agnostic, which is, I think, key to its role as in a lighting pipeline. If you get Katana today, you kind of need rendering to go with it. And because we've been collaborating a lot with Pixar for a long time now, and results of that particularly seen on the Blue Umbrella, the short that's been talked about a lot here at this SIGGRAPH. And a lot of that collaboration kind of brought us together, and it's allowed us to do this now where we can actually get Katana and we can get RenderMan with Katana for new customers for Katana.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting problem, isn't it? Because in theory, Katana doesn't specifically need to ship with a renderer, but of course you can't use it without a renderer. But more to the point, does it allow you to go beyond what you were able to do before with RenderMan? In other words, is this more just that I'm getting RenderMan, or has it now got a tighter integration with RenderMan?
That's a very much an ongoing thing, which is really good from both sides. So there's a lot of effort that has gone into improving the way the two products work together, and it's really just the beginning of a long road for both parties. So there's a lot more still to come. So very much today, this is something we can put in a customer's hands today, and they'll pretty much today get what's available today. But it's going to develop fairly rapidly over the next few months. So we see this as very much an ongoing relationship to improve the integration between the products.
Now, while we're really enthusiastic about this relationship with RenderMan, of course, Katana started with Sony, which had its own version of Arnold, and there are obviously people using other renderers. So in every respect, this doesn't tie me into that, but you're saying that I'll actually get it included if I choose to go that way.
Yeah, so the important thing as Katana gets developed further and spreads wider is that we'd quite like it to be the case that when you get Katana from the foundry, you should be able to load it up and hit render and get a picture out of it without requiring to know in advance what other renderers you might want to use with it. So this out-of-the-box experience is actually quite an important thing for us.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but if I was a TD or somebody setting up Katana previously, there was quite a bit of setup. So that's been reduced?
It will be reduced, but the key to it is actually being able to ship a renderer that can come with it. So there's always been that technical overhead simply because we didn't have any ability to get a production-proven renderer into people's hands at the same time we got Katana into their hands. So there's always going to be some wiring up involved, and this is really the first step of being able to do a much tighter integration over time.
Chris, you're obviously coming from this from a point of view of having sort of the gold standard, as I like to say, of renderers, which tends to mean that at the high end, you're very much in demand by the larger studios. That would seem to be a good fit with Katana.
Hi, Mike. Yes, actually, this was almost a natural fit for us, given the overlap between Katana in higher-end studios and RenderMan. And really, the way we look at this is really down with two threads. The first thread is that we actually, the RenderMan team, has been investing in development for Katana for some time now. In fact, we've actually hired an engineer who's been working on a lot of the integration issues because, you know, we recognize that Katana is a fundamental part of studio pipelines and will increasingly be so in the future. So that kind of makes sense to us. Secondly, of course, is the reality that we are rendering itself is evolving very, very rapidly, and the developments in RenderMan are advancing so quickly. You know, we're doing like three releases within the past year that we want to make that accessible in front of a very wide audience as effectively as possible, but also with an environment that enables it to plug into the existing assets of the user's pipeline. So working with Katana is kind of a natural fit for that. So those two threads are very important to us.
Also, I mean, if you went sort of at a philosophical level, one of the fundamental building blocks of RenderMan in the day was it could render any scene of any complexity, which then led to everybody trying to give it the most complex scenes available, which in turn is why you might want Katana, right? Because very, very complex scenes is where Katana kind of fits into the puzzle.
Yep, absolutely. But the goal is also to make it more out of the box so it's more approachable to other people, right? So not just used for the high end, but to be able to get into different users' hands. And that's why through this technical collaboration, we're looking to have as many out-of-the-box features that kind of help that experience. People can envision downloading it and then beginning to light a scene quickly without having a lot of technical experiences holding them back.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, actually. And I thought we could just discuss that as a group, because one of the things that certainly came out of some work we've been doing lately in looking at renderers is this trend, which is exemplified in the Blue Umbrella, to going to physically based shading and lighting, but more importantly than that, by setting up a system where the lighters are in a more, I guess, artistically friendly environment. Now, that was not just limited to Blue Umbrella. Of course, Monsters University had the same philosophy of trying to get the lighting team having a more enjoyable experience. And certainly, I know you've dramatically reduced the number of lights in some of those setups. But let's talk about that for a second, because one of the things that both sort of sides of this equation are trying to do is make that lighting a little less a data management role and a little more a creative role.
Right, absolutely. And I think one of the most fundamental aspects of this announcement today is that it really capitalizes on what we learned in making the Blue Umbrella, in what we know needs to be done moving forwards, and in fact what we've already scheduled development resource to do. So all of that kind of circles back round to why you know, a collaboration between us to develop a kind of a best-in-breed lighting workflow using the tools that, you know, frankly, you know, both our customers are using now makes perfect sense for us.
The thing about Blue Umbrella I think is really interesting is it isn't the biggest production in the world because it's a short film. So I'm kind of wondering now whether we're thinking about Katana and RenderMan being valid away from, if I could, just the main Pixar-level studio stuff, where, quite frankly, you guys can do anything you want, to kind of a mid-level. I mean, that, like, Blue Umbrella benefited from Katana. RenderMan was used in that short film. I mean, are we thinking that there's room there to expand Katana and RenderMan into sort of smaller productions through this?
Yeah, that's one of the key goals behind this technical collaboration is to make it easier, right? So, to, you know, eventually we'd love to have built-in shaders. And so someone can just download and have these things out of the box and have that experience. And as you said earlier, have people focus on the lighting element of it, not on the data management element of it. And through this technical collaboration and through these built-in features, you know, we think it's going to be easier for people at the mid-range studios to begin to use this solution.
And if I could just reinforce Chris's point, you know, we are developing at the moment significant new functionality in RenderMan that directly addresses the ease of use equation for some of these immensely complex and sophisticated scenes that not just high-end studios like the Pixars of this world are using, but, you know, a broader category of users also needs and wants to access. So, you know, we need some way of channeling the user input and the experience that you know, we have had and increasingly our customers will have into a format that is accessible. And this collaboration is something that actually will enable us to do that, we think, very effectively. Because to come back to the point that, you know, these are the tools that our customers and our prospects are using and want to use now.
And, you know, not today, but, you know, hopefully 6-12 months from now, we see it being able to be more pervasive in education as well. By having a package solution, it'll be easier for universities to download it and begin educating people on it and begin using it. And through this technical collaboration and that better out-of-the-box experience, we think it's really going to help us in that regard as well, which has been important and I think will be important for the industry as well.
Yeah, because it does seem to be a move from kind of a, to take nothing away from the approach, because it obviously works very, very well, but the sort of monolithic shader, very complicated shader-based solutions, to saying, well, we can make it actually complex in terms of the rendering, but move some of that into the rendering side of the equation. Maybe make some of the shaders a bit more physically based, a bit less like code-based, and that should facilitate it going to a kind of a wider audience, shouldn't it?
Right, absolutely. I mean, the work we've put into physically plausible shading, for example, in RenderMan directly plays to that general trend, which clearly, you know, is one of the big stories of rendering over the past year or two.
So what about scene complexity in Katana? I mean, maybe you could talk about because I mean, that's the thing that first got me interested in Katana, just the sheer ability to handle these very, very large scenes, which someone might typically want to render with RenderMan for a whole lot of reasons.
Yeah, so that's still one of the key things about Katana. So really, thinking of it purely as lighting is probably a bit too simplistic for the overall benefits of the package. And that work is still continuing a lot. So again, the experience of working with Pixar has again been a big input into that, because complexity is everywhere, even in short films. And there's a large amount of effort going on based on Pixar's feedback in their experience during that short, stuff we need to do anyway. And then again, if you look back at Sony Imageworks, who are clearly still very much involved in pushing the development of Katana, there's a lot of work going on there to improve the complexity management side of the product as well. So there's that side of it is hugely important to us.
Yeah, because there's that whole aspect of Katana being able to manage and sort of procedurally effectively get at materials and propagate that through and then version manage that. And obviously not in the case of Blue Umbrella, but, you know, sometimes you have a city that goes through various destruction phases and being able to refer into different versions of assets and stuff. There's an enormous amount of that which makes Katana valuable, independent, I guess, of the rendering lighting aspects.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes, that all still very much continues and is, again, hugely valuable, and hugely valuable to Pixar as well. It's not the most obvious part of this collaboration, but the addressing the complexity stuff is still huge.
How complex was Blue Umbrella? I mean, did it... The city scenes must have, you know, required a fair amount of instancing and large kind of sort of use of database structures.
I think the results speak for themselves, Mike, actually. I mean, obviously it was a highly complex production. You know, the quality of the images is, I think, astonishing. But that really just reflects the state of the art in RenderMan at this point in time. But I should really make this point clear that, you know, this is a learning process. You know, we probably learned more out of Brew Umbrella about what we need to do than we actually achieved with in the film itself. And that's another reason for our collaboration.
So just outline for me how this actually works, because this is the announcement. When does this take effect, and how does it actually work in this relationship between Katana and RenderMan?
Sure. So it starts today, where someone can come to us and purchase Katana. And when they purchase the standard GUI of Katana, for every GUI they purchase, they will be able to get an additional RenderMan license free of charge, up to 10 seats. And then in addition to that, they'll also get 10 Katana render licenses for each RenderMan license as well. So it's a ratio of for every one GUI, there's one RenderMan license, and then 10 Katana render licenses as well.
Okay, and how does this all impact from a pricing point of view?
So, well, it mitigates the cost, obviously, for someone to be able to get into Katana. Because before you had to, you know, obviously you had to purchase the Katana license, you had to purchase the Katana render license, and then you had to purchase the actual RenderMan license as well. And so it really mitigates that. So at this point in time, the first 10 RenderMan licenses are free, the first 50 Katana renders are free, and you're basically paying for the GUI. So it definitely mitigates the cost.
So is this like a special package, or is this standard? In other words, if I walk up to you and say, well, actually, I don't really want RenderMan because I already have it, do I get it at a cheaper price, or is it just like this is now standard packaging?
It's just a standard package. For existing customers, if they want to buy additional seats, for, you know, or for new customers, it's a standard package that'll we'll go forward with.
Well, brilliant. Well, that sounds really interesting. So we're here at SIDGRAPH. Obviously, a lot of people are really interested in this. So Chris, if I come to the RenderMan booth, can I find out about this?
Absolutely, yeah. We'd be more than happy to tell anyone about this news. And also, we have demonstrations on our booth that show RenderMan and Katana running together. We also actually have speakers who will be on the Foundry booth showing RenderMan and Katana together also. So, you know, this is very much a joint effort between both of us. So either booth will have plenty of information on this.
Right, but I assume that I can only buy Katana still from the Foundry, right?
That is correct.
Okay.
But we'll be working very closely together.
So I can also go to the Foundry booth here at SIDGRAPH, and I'm presuming online, right?
Yep, online as well as the booth. So we'll be here all week.
Okay, well, thanks so much for talking to us, guys. Really appreciate it.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Mike. I'm glad you caught up with those guys. That's exciting news. Let's join now. Mike also caught up with Lucas Martel. Mike?
Hey, Lucas. How are you, man?
I'm great. How about you, Mike?
So you got to see the keynote I didn't get to see, which mm-hmm. is the thing that everyone's been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think a little bit of a criticism can be aimed at SIDGRAPH for maybe not promoting this enough, because it sounded really interesting. Tell us about it.
It was fantastic. They had 9 animation directors, a couple just off the top of my head, Pete Docter, Chris Sanders, and a host of others. There's too many names to list all.
So now they were talking about animated films, but and obviously the industry today, but I also hear that some of them showed some student work of their own. Is that right?
Yeah, they showed a roughly 20-second clip from all the directors that was from their student work. Most of them were graduates of CalArts, so it was 20-second clip of, for instance, Eric Goldberg's student film.
Now, for those people that are listening to this that obviously couldn't make it to SIDGRAPH, this apparently is going to go up on either YouTube or some website, because it was done in association with, I believe, the Academy and somebody else. So this is something that you will be able to pick up on. But I certainly didn't get to see it. I'm looking forward to seeing that video. Mm-hmm. So I guess, was there a mood on the panel? Was it upbeat, or were they pessimistic about things at the moment?
No, it was very upbeat, but one of the things that I definitely responded to and thought was really great was that they were talking about not only some of the great things about sort of the, you know, how technology has enabled new, basically more people to make animated films, but they were also talking a good bit about some of the business concerns and how that's changed the way the industry works.
So I guess from a sort of a historical point of view, most of these guys, what, came up from 2D? Did you say they were?
Yeah, most of them were CalArts. They all had 2D backgrounds, even though several of them have transitioned into 3D, and Henry Selick is obviously doing stop motion.
And so today they're in this big environment, because a lot of these people are talking about, I mean, collectively we're talking about billions of dollars of box office revenue.
Yeah.
In what I guess has traditionally been one of the most successful genres ever, which is children's or younger animated feature type stuff. I mean, it's been huge, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was actually one of the things that they talked about, because they have all been through this sort of, you know, there was a time in, you know, just a decade ago where animation wasn't really a viable thing. It looked like it was on its way out, and then with CG and several other, you know, technological advancements, it's really sort of came back, and now it's to the point where even most live action films have more animation in them than they seem to have live action. But they were also sort of commenting on how the industry has gotten so big that now it's very, very difficult to make a film that has sort of an artist stamp of approval, because when you've got a budget of $200 million and P&A that's going to at least be $100 million plus, you know, on in addition to that, it's very, very difficult to do something that basically to take any risks.
I mean, you're an animation director. We know that because you're teaching an animation course at FX PhD this term. Mm-hmm. As an animator, as a director of animated films, was there any sort of directorial aspects that they were picking up on in terms of storytelling, or was it not really like that?
They definitely talked about some general storytelling stuff. They talked a lot about collaboration. I know one of the things that I personally really responded to was they were talking about how going through the student stuff and how they had to sort of do everything themselves. They commented how it was great to do that and know how to do all those specific aspects, but then learning how to trust other people to do those and to basically learn how to collaborate, and how that was a very big step in shaping who they are.
I don't know if you got to it, but there was a session on The Blue Umbrella, the Pixar short film, yesterday, and in that they went through the stages of the notes they got, which I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. Very much picking up on that point you were just making about collaboration, because he was saying, look, we would show this to people all the time. People in story, I think he described it as, but it wasn't because they wanted to be managed by committee. They were just trying to say, hey, like, what do people respond to? What do people not quite understand?
Yeah.
What is it that's not connecting through here? And they knew what they were trying, or the director knew what he was trying to communicate. But sometimes the best will in the world, that wasn't getting through the language of cinema effectively, especially in that film, which had really no dialogue.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I got into Seagraph just after that panel, because that was the very first one this year's Seagraph. But they did talk about a couple of similar things at this panel, especially in terms of taking notes and having, I mean, several of them mentioned having people to give them feedback and in order to make the film the best they can. I know, I believe it was Eric Goldberg also had a really good comment about how ultimately animation, it's still about telling a story, and the thing that so many of them are constantly looking for and sometimes missing in work that's not quite to that level is the lack of story. It might look cool, or it might have some fantastic technical or even visual aspects to it, but if it doesn't tell a story, it doesn't engage the audience.
Yeah, I mean, we say that all the time. Obviously, you know, you need to tell a story, but I was fascinated when you hear somebody at that level talking. Mm-hmm. Like, we should, I think, define, it's not just sort of broadly, you know, is there a start, middle, and an end, but it's really like what is this part, like, for example, when we were looking at Blue Umbrella, he would say, okay, at this point, if anyone's seen the film, the city responds to the umbrella. Mm-hmm. And he'd say, well, the trouble we had with the story at this point was we've established that they're friends, but then he looks like he's going to die, and the city doesn't help. So isn't that kind of creepy? And so we had to kind of think of that in a story way, like how could we, without breaking the story, still find a way to make that interaction, which was so important, be valid later in the story. Mm-hmm. And these are kind of subtle points that they fixed with just the smallest of little kind of fixes, in some cases just a cutback or a look or mm-hmm. And the other one which I thought was interesting, I hadn't really thought about, but you must think about this all the time, is that idea of what do we, the audience, know that the character doesn't know, and then the character might look out of frame and they know something that I don't know. Mm-hmm. And get that sort of response of, when is it appropriate for me to know more than the character, or the character to know more than the audience?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I guess specifically I don't have any thoughts on the what the character and audience knows so much, but I do know this as far as even one of the things from the panel that they mentioned was just not only being able to tell a story, but knowing how to cinematically tell a story. And I think that sort of falls into exactly what you're describing in terms of when you're telling a movie, when you're making a movie, it has to be visual, and you need to convey all those story points from a visual standpoint. And especially when you're doing it without dialogue, that's a whole nother set of challenges that you really have to be confident, and you have to get your point across very clearly and very concisely.
Yeah, that cinematic framing is a wonderful part of animation directing, I think, because you can do anything. Mm-hmm. But then what you want to do is find that framing, that blocking, that is maybe reinforcing the emotional story, mm-hmm. maybe not logically telling the audience, but a long lens isolating someone from a background can be underlying their emotional position at that point in the story.
Yeah.
And when we say story, that's as valid as the logical story of, okay, where is this character physically going in the plot?
Yeah, I mean, typically I know whenever I say the word story, I'm not just talking about the plot, I'm also talking about what the audience is sort of feeling, where things are going emotionally, the character arcs. To me, I think when most people say story, they're referring to the entirety of the experience, I believe.
Yeah, it's incredibly subtle, isn't it? And I love it when you sort of have that blanket statement like, it's all about story, but then you're looking at finding ways to tell a story in color, in obviously music, but in, you know, like just lens choices, in like all of these other things that immediately don't come to mind perhaps, but...
Yeah.
And of course, I love your work and the stuff that you've done in this area. And I was saying, I think, to you yesterday, some of the stuff in Pigeon Impossible where you had, just nothing happening, as it were, because it's a look or it's the beat. Mm-hmm. It's what's not being said. It's all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of times, you can convey a lot, or sometimes it's even just the comedy that you get out of that awkward beat before something happens or a reaction, or there's so many ways of doing that and film is the only place that you really have that that can be a very, very big part of the film and the tone of it.
Yeah, I've got to say, I'm coming back to that whole point you started with, which was collaboration. Mm-hmm. I think that's something that you sometimes find with people that are newer to film. The idea that if I didn't think of it, it's, a fault because I'm the director. I should have all the ideas, right? Mm-hmm. I remember Ron Howard talking about this. He said on his first film, people would come and ask him, and... he had sort of, I think it was two, I'm pretty sure it was Ron Howard, had two responses to this. First of it is, he thought that he should have an answer for everything, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's the director. But also, he was like wanting to be collaborative. So he'd say, well, whatever you want, you should feel free to contribute. And the guy would be like, well, what color do you want the fence? He'd be like, what color do you think it should be? And he's like, mm-hmm. I was like, mate, just tell me what color you want, because I can do whatever color you want, but I don't know what you're trying to do. So,
yeah.
So it's that interesting thing. You obviously want to be collaborative. You want to take input in. You obviously still need a vision, a voice, to mm-hmm. express it. It's a really interesting role.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the things that I'm most adamant about, is that I feel like there's a lot of films and filmmakers, and not to point anyone out specifically, but who tend to direct by just being offered, a choice between a couple of different things. Then instead of saying, well, like, basically they have a very difficult time conveying what it is that they want. And so then, especially this is a big problem in visual effects, the artist has to go through and create 5 different versions, and then they just pick the best one, as opposed to saying, here's what I want, and then directing the artist to what it is that they want. So I think there is a very fine line in the whole, like, you need to know what it is that you're after, and you need to know how to steer the ship towards that. But at the same time, you need to leave a little bit of room for the artist to fill in the details and create those little nuances that are really going to elevate it.
I can only again go back to Blue Umbrella because I saw it yesterday, this talk, but exactly that was brought up. There's a point in the film quite early on where the blue umbrella meets the red. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, the director asked for the animator to just provide something along the lines that would sort of enhance the romantic connection, because they're looking at each other, they were clearly interested in each other, but just didn't quite feel like, and he said, what I want is that thing that you would look back on, in years to come, as remember that funny time when we first met, which gave the old idea of the umbrella going upside down and revealing underneath. And then he said, but there's still this thing, there was this one shot before that, they just needed something. So he just said to the animator, have fun with it, I don't care how long you take, but I need this kind of something to really sort of endear that link, that we believe that they're really falling in love. Mm-hmm. And the animator came up with this idea of the umbrella just turning away and looking kind of like, oh, I didn't mean to do that, so dorky. And there's this tiny little, like, sort of, God, that's such a dorky look that the blue umbrella has. Mm-hmm. Just totally came from the animator. It's all it needed. Mm-hmm. And as the audience, we all smile and just feel it and connect it. And it was the genius of the director at that moment saying, I'm not going to tell you what to do. This is the sort of that response that I want emotionally, and see what you can come up with. I totally agree. It's a fine line to walk.
Yeah, that's a lot of times I'll sometimes call that like my sandbox. Like a lot of times when I'm giving direction, I kind of try to define the bounds of what it is that needs to happen in a shot, so that they know that, okay, the character needs to get from point A to point B, and we need to accomplish this specific thing in this shot. It might not be any more specific than that, than what you just described, like we need to convey this sense of blank. But as long as you can give an animator at least those specific directions, they have some room to play and to be creative, but they're not just blank slate trying to come up with anything.
Yeah. So that director thing, how long did that go for? It was like about an hour and a half this morning, was it?
It was an hour and a half, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, we must be looking, keep an eye out for that on YouTube and stuff. And I would imagine that was a pretty busy session. I imagine that was pretty popular.
It was in the arena. It was pretty close to full.
Wow, great. Well, look, so great you taking time out to talk to us, and thanks for filling us in on that.
Thanks, Mike.
Mike, I'm really glad we ran into Lucas. I when we were recording something earlier in the day, I saw this big crowd moving out of one of the halls, and everybody was coming out of that session, and everybody was really raving about it. So I'm glad we got to get some firsthand reporting from that.
As soon as we got the YouTube link for that, we'll post it.
And, yeah, I think the Academy's going to have it. Somebody told me it's going to be on the Oscars site, so we'll find out about that. But Lucas is great, and we've known him obviously for a long time, and if you want to look up Lucas, he's... film was called Pigeon Impossible, and there's a story on FX Guide about it, which I'm sure has a link. And
yeah, I think if you Google Pigeon Impossible, you'll get a ton of connections to his work. He is great, and I mean, he's just a really talented director.
And you said he's doing a class in PhD this term. He's done one before for us, and now
he did
doing a new one.
An application-specific course before a while ago, but this is a directorial course where he's really looking at character animation. And yeah, it's just a treat to be working with him.
That's awesome. So yesterday you hosted a panel, you were the moderator of a panel on open source, and I got there a little late, but I was really intrigued by the discussions that were going on. It was a great group. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, no, it was good, the open source panel, and in fact, there was some stuff there that we were talking about in terms of the sort of the trends in the industry and stuff, and we'll hopefully be able to loop around on some of that, as well as, of course, just identifying the individual stuff that has been happening with the companies that were speaking. So we actually had there people talking from, for example, Sony about what was happening with Olympic and the new version 1.5 is released. But the talk itself wasn't actually like a rundown on, say, Olympic. It was more just, you know, discussing the issues around open source with, in this case, Rob from Sony as somebody that was there talking. In fact, we actually spoke to Rob today, and we actually have a little piece that we can give you about that in terms of 1.5. Let's just play that now. So, Rob, it's an interesting trend that the studios, of which Sony, of course, is a major player, are actually moving to open source for some of their development.
Yeah, we've seen a real trend in all the major studios, all the major players in our business, for both visual effects and animation, where the big players are contributing substantial libraries, substantial core bits of technology back to the greater open source community. And this is for a number of different reasons, but it is a very, very interesting trend, and I'm really excited to see this kind of progress in our business recently.
Does that foster more competition or actually less as people all use the same tools?
Well, it kind of does a little bit of both. It sort of raises the bar. So let's say some of the smaller or medium-sized studios that didn't have access to these tools in the past, now they have access to these core libraries like Alembic or OpenSubdiv, and they can put it right into their pipeline without having to do the years of development that it took the big studios to build all that software. So it raises the bar in that way. But it also kind of increases, because we're all collaborating on some of the same basic tools, it actually increases competition. Now we're able to compare notes. So I got a note from a guy at Pixar that said Alembic wasn't as fast as what their internal system was. And this was because he could look at Alembic. He could try it out in his pipeline, and he could say, in these certain cases, their internal system was 3 times faster. So then, of course, that raised the bar for us. We were challenged then to try to meet or beat their performance. And actually, we're just releasing a new version of Alembic, our geometry library, this SIGGRAPH, to improve the performance in some cases by 40 times. So it's kind of increasing the amount of collaboration, which also increases the amount of competition. Open source is great for a lot of reasons, but one of the really interesting side effects of sharing software with the world is the developers who are creating these tools are now going to know, they know that their code is going to be on display for the world to see, with their name on it and what lines were written by whom. So it's a good way of airing the dirty laundry. If you're going to say, hey, I'd like to open source that project, usually the first response from any developer is, okay, give me a couple months to clean it up, because I'd love it to be the representation of my best work. So I think some of our cleanest code and some of our best documented code is the stuff we've actually given away to the world, some of our best work, because everyone wants to put their name on something that they're really proud of.
And this really is free. Anyone can access it.
Yeah, we've chosen very non-restrictive open source licenses. So the license we've chose basically says you can do anything you want with it. You can even branch it and resell it if you want. And as long as you don't hold us responsible for the results, you can take a look at the code. If you like it, go ahead and use it for anything you'd like.
Thanks so much.
Great.
One of the things I found really fascinating in the panel was the discussion of the licensing and the issues with making things open source, which I certainly hadn't considered before. And the, one of the kind of things they brought up was that, in fact, what you really want is not a humongous legal license. You want to have a very simple legal license that says, basically, this is free. You can do what you want with it, and you can't sue us. You can't come back to us, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the stuff that was happening there wasn't a rundown of each of the individual things like Olympic or whatever, because it was discussing, as I say, these sort of more complex issues around the process, how hard it is to get something to be published, because, of course, you've got to sort of take it out of your pipeline and cut it free, as well as, of course, making sure that all the code's in good order. But I agree that that licensing thing was the thing. I'll tell you another one that's really interesting. I think it was Bill from Pixar was talking about this. The idea that I think he was talking about it. Anyway, it's like it might have been Kevin from DreamWorks, Disney. Anyway, one of the two guys said that their team deleted their own software that they'd put into the open source community. They literally deleted it. And then if anyone wants to use it, they have to go and download it from the open source.
From GitHub.
Yeah. So as to guarantee that they are using the open source version and they're contributing back to the community, they don't have their own version of the software.
Yeah, that was interesting.
To get the latest version, they go and get it themselves. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and also the complexity of, you work on software for a long time and then you decide you're going to take it down this open source path, but you've got to go through the software and make sure some engineer, some knight didn't just cut and paste a piece of code from somewhere and not document that, because somebody can, especially these big companies, they can be opened up to somebody coming after them and suing them.
Somebody could even put a sample piece of code in a SIDGRAPH paper, but at the bottom of that paper it has, if you want to use this, you need to just get a license from here. It's free, but you still have to get a license, and if you don't get the license and use it, you're in violation of those agreements. I mean, look, it is a complicated issue, but certainly the community's benefited enormously from OpenEXR, from the stuff with OpenVDB, which has just taken off and has been all over the place. We saw, just looping back to where we started this morning, OpenVDB was actually in one of those talks this morning that was being done as part of the solution. Houdini, but that water solution was also a combination of what was going on with OpenVDB as well, to basically manage these sparse data sets. So there's a lot of these open source things that are just popping up all over the place, which is incredibly interesting. OpenColor.io, not to mention the stuff that OpenSubdiv, which I think is terrific. That isn't the end of it. There's a bunch of open source. Of course, one of the people speaking on the panel was Tan from Blender, and Blender, the entire program, is open source.
Right. Yeah, that was really interesting. There were just so many issues raised in that panel. And this is kind of what I love about SIDGRAPH, is you come and you get, the breakdowns like we saw this morning. You get the panel about this, the open source stuff. You get there's just such a wide variety. Business issues, there's two business issue panels this year.
Yeah. Are you talking about the ones coming up?
Yeah, later in the week.
You posted something about that on FX Guide, right? Like, what are they?
Yeah, there's two of them. There's a one of them is on Tuesday. I don't know when this is coming out. It may have already happened, but it's it's kind of the usual suspects.
Out on Tuesday morning.
Oh, okay. So yeah, it's kind of the usual suspects that you've heard at some of the VFX town halls. This, Scott Squires and Dave Rand and Steve Kaplan from the Animation Guild, and that one's Tuesday. And then that's open, interestingly, to the people with exhibit passes, which is nice because a lot of sessions are not.
I've got here 11 to 1, room 213, reading. Quoting back to you, your own article.
Story, yes, which I don't have in front of me, so that's good. And that one is an open to the exhibits group. And then on Thursday afternoon, there's one, and that one adds Scott Ross and the lawyer that I interviewed from... David Yosis from the law firm that did the feasibility study. So it's interesting. Obviously, the business issues, as I said in that little short article, have raised their heads, and so it's good to see SIDGRAPH addressing those and giving a platform. And these types of sessions are really good because people do get up and ask questions, and it's a nice interactive small room.
We had about 300 people, I think 350 people for the open source And that was a good, I felt, good-sized room, good-sized group of people.
And some of these rooms, like the papers, the fast-forward papers room, that must be thousands.
That is thousands, yeah.
And there were people standing.
Yeah, paper for fast-forward is a huge... And we just also saw Mark downstairs from Side Effects Software, one of the principal architects of Houdini. He's running the
Dailies
program, which we've also been plugging over at FX Guide. So just to plug it here, you'll be hearing this on Tuesday. On Wednesday, the Dailies is on. It's 44 artists doing 90 seconds on one particular aspect of one particular shot that they've worked on.
So just like Papers Fast Forward, in case you don't know, Papers Fast Forward, they actually, this year, it was the format was 30 seconds. You got up and you had 30. Every paper that's been presented this year at SIGGRAPH gets explained in 30 seconds.
I felt that the Fast Forward papers maybe was a little too short now. I mean, the whole night's long, but the, you know, just 30 seconds doesn't really... You got to see a couple of clips and maybe that whetted your appetite, but there was only a few that I kind of, oh, I know what that is already, that I was like...
Yeah.
I don't know, there's a
no,
few...
No, I agree. It's always a tough balance, and it also kind of depends on the flow, because some go for a real quick try to sneak, get out what the paper is, and others go for a variation from slightly cutesy to, oh my God, that's ridiculous. But that's part of the fun. But sometimes you just kind of get three of those in a row and you go, okay.
So imagine that you'd do a Fluid Sims talk. One of the fast forwards last night had a guy who basically for the 15 of his 30 seconds was doing a Super Soaker ad from the 70s that then came down to, if you want to learn about this area of fluids, come to my paper. And that is, I think, the 30-second risk, that it is, I'm only going to pose the problem and nothing about the solution.
Right.
Like if you want to know how to make buildings collapse across an entire city, come to my paper.
Right.
Versus at 90 seconds, you can say, our paper is about how to make buildings collapse.
And you're also right. Right.
We're using this technique based on something else. It's revolutionary. It's faster. It's better. It's easier. It's quicker. Dot, dot, dot. Here's an example before.
You know, if I could make a suggestion to the SIGGRAPH folks, and I don't know how they've done an app this year. That's for the iPhone, you know, I guess Android's iPhone. I don't know. I know it's on iPhone and iPad.
What's an Android?
I don't know. I've never seen one.
Okay.
But it would be really great if there was a section in that app that had simply the papers listed in the order they're going to present and a way to checkbox them as they go by for the ones that you're interested in. Because I found myself in the next 30 seconds trying to find that one and make a note that I wanted to see it. And it just was not possible. And some of the names of the sessions are kind of clever as well. So you're trying to find that.
This is a point that I am really concerned about, this trend towards super cleverer and cleverer names of papers. The trouble is, the problem with an in-joke is you have to be in on it for it to be a joke. Otherwise, it's just obtuse. It's just, you know, it's not inclusive. So if you don't understand what's going on and you don't get the... You know, I mean, look, let's face it, SIGGRAPH is rife with, it rivals Comic-Con for geek humor at times.
But, yeah.
Unless you're in on those very esoteric, humorous, mathematical puns, you're like, what?
Yeah. Oh, it's like the grilled cheese shop with the blend sandwich and grilled cheese sandwich.
The actual grilled cheese sandwich is named after computer
Yeah, the Ed
legends.
Catmull. Yes. Catmelt.
Catmelt, yes. Okay, well, that's about it for this podcast for today. Thanks so much for being with us, Jeff. It's just obviously so much better having the two of us. Last night I was recording this by myself about midnight, and it was less entertaining without you, my friend.
Yeah, I'm sorry we lost John today. He was here with us all day today, but he had to go back and do more work on the site.
Yes, actually he's doing work for PhD, and PhD continues at full throttle. There's some really good stuff up on FXPhD. You should check it out over at fxphd.com. Thanks so much for being with us, and thanks everyone for coming up to us during the show. Jeff, I'm sure you've had the same experience I have.
It's been fantastic. I mean, people are so nice and appreciate, you know, people coming up and talking to us and saying hi and thanking us and just chatting with us. It's been great.
And thanks to people like The Foundry and Pixar, who are going out of their way to give us stuff ahead of time so we can get it to you live as a podcast, as it were, so you can listen in the second that the press release is actually going out. We do appreciate you guys taking us into your confidence and doing that kind of stuff. It makes it so much easier to get beyond just the straight press release. And we've got more stuff posted on the site, more stuff coming up, and of course there's other stuff in addition to SIGGRAPH, such as our in-depth look at the pipeline of Pacific Rim, which is this week's FX Guide TV over at fxguide.com. You should check that out. We went up to ILM, sat down with John Knoll, Eddie Lindy, Hal Hickel, just a ton of the team. But the pipeline just covers not in a specific order, how various tools are used at ILM, such as Nuke, Houdini, Katana, Moto, Olympic, Arnold, and RenderMan, and ILM's own 3D fluid destruction sims and muscle sims. And it's a good comprehensive story. We appreciate ILM for giving us such amazing access to that. And that's available, as I say, episode 175.
Hard to believe that, FX Guide TV. And we filmed a bunch of stuff today that'll surely make it into an upcoming FX Guide TV episode as well.
Thanks so much, guys. Talk to you soon.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.